Hello and welcome to Day to Day. This week, I am joined by our atmospheric composition expert and guide, Dr. Federico Feely. Federico, welcome.
Thanks, you, Mark, and welcome to all our guests and friends.
So we unusually are in different places. I'm at my home here in Seeheim-Jugendheim, so just south of Darmstadt. Whereabouts are you?
I am as well at home in my flat in Sachsenhausen, that is just south of Frankfurt. And I mean, this is clearly due to the fact that we have to keep care of ourselves and our colleagues and our friends and all the citizens during this crisis.
Yeah, so we're both distant and in our homes. And of course, the satellites are still operating. So there are some very few people who are going into EUMETSAT to maintain the health of the spacecraft, to make sure that the instruments on board are all still working, and that all the data that is flowing from those spacecraft and from those instruments is getting out to the users around the world all the time. Obviously, the operation of our satellites and the data that we produce is used by services, including in public health. And in our interview with Stijn Vermoter, we will hear some of how the data is being used in public health at this time. But Federico, just as we start, do you want to talk about how we are seeing the current change in our behavior in the satellite data? How is the COVID impact on our behavior visible from space?
Yes, absolutely. I think most of us have seen the image from the new Copernicus satellite Sentinel-5P that have been distributed in the social, in the news, on the reduction of pollution. So these images are based on data, on numerical data that are provided operationally by satellites, and are a sort of an image, is perceived as an image of the effect of the lockdown procedures for managing the COVID crisis. I mean, we can say that these are somewhat iconical and are a sort of an image that is marking these days. These are, I mean, not only a photo, as we say, they are based on numerical values on concentrations. The concentration is the number of molecule of a certain pollutant, in that case a gas that is composed by two atoms of oxygen and one atom of nitrogen that is produced by combustion. And the concentration, as we said, is the number of molecules per volume.
So what in we're doing case, from the satellite perspective is we're looking down on the top of the atmosphere and we can't say from the satellite exactly where that gas is in the vertical column, but we can say how much of it is in the vertical column.
We can say how much gas is in the lower part of the atmospheric vertical column that is observed from the satellite, from the top. However, this type of gas are mostly concentrated close to the ground. So we can really see the spots of the places where more emissions are. And that this happens in the case of this gas that is produced by combustion closer to the more populated area. And that this is why we also do observe the clear reduction, or the strongest reduction during the lockdown, because part of the activities are clearly stopped, like, for instance, the private transport, the flight. There is also a likely reduction of the industrial activities, but again, what will be important in the future is to understand at the end to which extent the activities were stopped and how this impact on what we observe from pollution.
So what are some of the interesting cases that you and colleagues have been looking at just now? Are there any areas of particular interest where you've been looking at the data?
The interesting area are now, given the fact that this is a pandemic and that there is a lockdown almost everywhere in the world, is a global issue. Is really a global story. Of course, we started chronologically from China, so the colleagues from the different weather offices, the Commission, the component of Copernicus started to see what was happening in China in January and February. And then, of course, we moved to Europa, we moved to the US to understand to which extent this exceptional situation, this exceptional crisis, but is also an exceptional situation for the change in the anthropogenic, in the human generated emissions, is a changing the atmosphere. I mean, we are also seeing from our windows, and there are also photos, pictures of the change in air quality or in the opacity of the air. I mean, we can see that in India. We can also see that in the most polluted towns. But what will be very important in the near future, in the really nearest future, is that the Copernicus and the space program, the observation program that is crucial for Copernicus, so will help to better understand and to quantify what is happening and what has happened. And it is also very, very important to have the possibility to look at the past, because it's essential. For instance, what we are doing now is to put this year, the year 2020, in perspective with respect to the past. So how much the pollution is reduced, how much is reduced with respect to 10 years ago or 20 years ago, where we had in many places in the world, in many regions that have implemented containment program for air quality, the satellite, they do observe already a reduction in pollution. But I mean, again, this year is really an exceptional situation. Again.
So just, I mean, so one of the cases we've been looking at is, of course, the Po Valley, so northern Italy. And there you've got, okay, the mountains make a difference because they act as a physical barrier to the flow of the air. So they can act to either create a circumstance where the pollution will build up, or if the wind is flowing the right way, to help the air get nice and cleared. How do you tell the difference between meteorology and human behavior? How do you do that?
This is very complex because the meteorology plays a huge role, as you said. I mean, if you have wind, if you have a ventilation, of course, you change the condition for quality. Or even if you have rain, rain is a very powerful wash up for most pollutants. One of the way that we are doing, and are doing also many colleagues that are really active and really involved in that all around Europe, using a lot of the Copernicus data, is, as we said, to put in perspective, to make a sufficient long average over time to smooth out, to reduce the role of the variability of pollution. Because, I mean, we can say that, for instance, the 15th of March 2019 is different in terms of meteorological condition from the same precise day the following year. But we can probably say that the average of the winter in 2020, or the average of February, March, April, on average from meteorology, it can be quite similar and can be compared, for instance, to the previous 10 years. So these are statistical approaches that, of course, need of long or sufficiently long term time series. And that this is where the operational and space program also become essential. It's not just to provide it's very important, really very important, but to provide a photo of what is now happening, but also to provide a historical memory.
And so it's when people are looking at the photo, that kind of, if they're looking at a picture where they can say, look, you can compare, there's lots of pollution now, there's less pollution at this time, you compare these two things, you can go, okay, there has been a change in our behavior. But if you actually want to do numbers, then I think what you're saying is this gets a bit harder. You need the longer satellite record, and you need to be a little bit more careful about the difference between meteorology, about human behavior, if you actually want to get statistics out. But when people are looking at these images, they're definitely looking at a coronavirus lockdown-based signal.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it is also important to look at the different pollutants.
So what's different for different pollutants?
The different pollutants, the pollutants are different because of the sources. They are produced by different processes. Let's think, for instance, to ammonia. Ammonia is a smelling substance that is also in the cleaning products, for instance, but is a part of the so-called nitrogen cycle. So it is produced by agriculture, by farming. And ammonia, for instance, is very volatile, so it reacts very quickly and is really, really confined to the emission region, to the production region. That is, of course, where intensive farming and intensive agriculture happens. And these can be observed by satellite. This can be observed by Copernicus and EUMETSAT satellites. For instance,
so there's a bit of a link between the actual activity and the sort of chemicals that we can observe in the atmosphere.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, once the pollutants are emitted in the atmosphere, they enter in the game of meteorology, of transport, but also on the chemical reaction that can happen and change their concentration. One of the another important part are the particles. So not molecules, but what we call the particulate matter. We have seen often the code PM2.5 or PM10. So it means a particulate matter of different size, and these are produced by anthropogenic activity, so by humans, but for instance by heating, by the chimneys, by burning wood, and for instance their concentration in the Po Valley was not so different before and after lockdown, due to the fact that the Italians and the whole Italy, they were stuck home and they used probably heating more than before.
So it's only the where there's actually been a change in our behavior, of course, that we see the changes in the particulates. I get asked a few questions about this kind of thing. And one thing I wanted to ask you was, a few people have asked, look, when I look at the sky now on a nice clear day, the sky somehow looks bluer. And I notice there are less planes around. Is the sky bluer at the moment? Is that just a perception thing? Is it really true?
I think it's because of me and you, and I mean all our colleagues and friends in EUMETSAT, we live very close to the Frankfurt airport. That is one of the main hubs in Europe, as we know. I mean, we know that the aircraft, they can produce under certain meteorological condition of temperature the condensation trails that are composed, of course, of condensed water, but they can be persistent. So you have a sort of less blue sky on top, and that this is of course due to the fact that also the air traffic is shut down. The other, let's say, bluer skies, we have seen the image in India, is related to the presence of the particulate matter, so to the aerosol. They have the capacity to darken the atmosphere due to the reflection of the light. And so you have less sunlight and then you have less blue light, because the blue is produced by interaction of the sunlight with the molecules that compose the atmosphere. And that this is clearly due to the reduction of the traffic. So there is a clear causality relation. And that brings us to the question of health. That is clear. That is really important. So it is well known that pollution has to do with the health, because the exposure to pollution increases the risk of lung diseases, but also of blood pressure, of the incidence of cancer. There are studies, and this is something that is getting more and more proven with the larger epidemiological databases. And also what will be important is to understand, to which extent a reduction of pollutant like this may be beneficial on the long term. So it is also a message that we can have for the starting phase.
So it's kind of a mini laboratory to change, because some things have been switched off, not everything, and we can see what the changes are, what effects they really have on the atmospheric composition system.
Yes, absolutely, exactly. There are specific observational campaigns that have been set up. I mean, with all the difficulties of the situation of the case, but there are colleagues that have made the scientific observation really to quantify in the detail what has happened, for instance, in Po Valley. The instruments were coming from different countries, and then there were scientists going with a mask, with a special permission to sound the air quality. And of course, this is complemented by the satellite measurements, because of the local measurements that they provided what's really happening with really fine resolution on the process, while the satellite really helps in putting also in a global perspective.
So the other question I get asked quite often, which is slightly more complicated in a way, is there a relationship between the air quality, and in particular small particles like what we would call PM2.5, and the coronavirus itself? Have you bumped into any research on that particular topic?
We are all looking at that really carefully, because it's a huge question. It's a really big question mark. This should be taken with care on one side, because establishing a clear or a defined causal relation between increases in particulate matter and the power of the virus to spread more efficiently is really complex. And despite there are some news, or there are some groups that try to find that this type of relation, is not really easy. But of course, what we know is that the pollution has a role in reducing the expected lifetime, due to the impact, as we said, on the respiratory system, on the blood pressure, and so on. And that is maybe a cofactor for deficiency of the virus in order to increase the number of casualties and to increase the number of death. One among the different studies that comes from the Harvard University, and they really made a huge job starting to put together, the different factors that influence the severity of the virus in a population, and they find out that the amount of pollution, but not the instant pollution, the pollution that was in the living surroundings for years. So what we call the total exposure, or the long term exposure, was related potentially to the severity of the virus. But this is really something where we really have to work, and I think that the coronavirus crisis is also changing the priority of the agenda, and clearly the information that comes from operations, space programs, from the Copernicus component, they are already giving answer, and they will give more and more answer in the future, and we need to be able, as I think we will discuss later with our guest, we need to be able to put this data, this information, for different type of users, different type of science communities, because now more than ever we really need to be to cross the borders and to make use at our maximum of the data sets, of the information that comes from the European programs.
Because we're going to get to talk to Stijn Vermote from the Copernicus Atmosphere Service in a minute. How's it going for you in terms of being able to relate to partners and keep in touch, all the communication at this time?
This was a great fear, because we have to admit that in EUMETSAT, but in many other places, doing teleworking and keeping the system operational, and also not only that, but also answering to new needs, like the one providing, as we are doing now, timely information about the coronavirus crisis, because there is a huge demand, a strong demand from the European Commission that at the end pays the Copernicus program I mean, to gather information for the decision. And I absolutely surprised and getting really optimistic about the fact that everything is going well. It's going well. I think there is a mix between the sense of responsibility, between the willing to work together, the willing to cooperate, the willing to make our best. I mean, this is at the end what happens in all our data. So we are sort of, we are part of a chain that that goes from building the instruments, putting the instruments in orbit with the European Space Agency, Copernicus supporting the build-up of new instruments from that to the to EUMETSAT that put the data on the system, to the European Center that simulate the data, up to the uptake from the services and from the Commission Commission itself. So it's a big game that that is essential, and I think we are really playing really with a sense of responsibility and also a passion, a really willing to do something important and something that is needed now.
I think for me, it's sort of the whole situation has brought out the best of us and the worst of us, and I think part of the best of us that this has brought out is all the partnerships that we've been working on for so many years. They just carry on working because we've invested all the time, because we've gotten to know each other, because we actually have a sense of communication with each other already. And actually, because we're remote from each other, to carry on communicating works quite straightforwardly. So I've been really quite pleased in a lot of ways with how that's kept on going. One other thing I just wanted to mention before we move on to talk to Steen was, if people want to find out more about the satellites and how we monitor things and sort of the background information behind the satellite components of all this, they can go to atmosphere.mooc.org. And you've been working on some more training resources. Do you want to talk a little bit about that just now?
Yes, absolutely. We are doing all our best, for instance, to have a different type of workshop information, live webinars, access to data available online. Of course, we cannot travel. We cannot make the people travel for the safety and also, I mean, to keep them with their family or to their duties. But it's extremely important to continue to grow and to have training on new things. I mean, especially in this moment where you probably have to put different things together. And for this, you can really go on the EUMETSAT page. I mean, just finding the training, and there is the list of the training event. And also go on the Copernicus page. There is a very nice communication part where you can find all the Copernicus events that are coming in the next months.
And of course, you're working at the moment on the fire workshop, which is your next thing to come up. And if people want to know more about that, they can listen to the last podcast we did together, which was all about fire.
Yes, absolutely. This is diffused on Twitter, on EUMETSAT Twitter. So just go on the Twitter account of EUMETSAT, follow EUMETSAT, and go also on our Facebook page, and you will find all the information there.
So earlier on in the week, we got to talk to Steen Vermote from the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. It was great to check in with him, see how he's doing, to see how the whole Copernicus system, in a way, is responding to the current health crisis. And in particular, talk about what the CAMS products are doing for the public health across Europe.
So it gives me a great pleasure now to turn to our guest for this week, Steen Vermote from ECMWF, the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, and CAMS. Welcome, Steen.
Good morning. Hi, Mark.
How are you?
I'm fine, yes. Relaxed at home. We're doing fine here.
So CAMS, can you explain just a tiny bit about CAMS?
So CAMS is the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. So it's one of the services of the European Commission, focusing on the atmospheric composition. What we do in CAMS is to look at air quality, to look at pollen, and of course we can give a great deal of information about the impacts of COVID-19 or the try to understand the spread.
So Federico and I were talking earlier about how the satellites are, of course, still working. They're still monitoring the atmosphere. They're still monitoring the environment. CAMS, you're all at home. You're all working from home right now. Are you still operational?
We are still fully operational. So within CANS and ECMDAF in general, we are able to run our operations in a fully operational way from home. We have our operations still in place in Reading, so that's good. And all the rest can all be tracked from home. Yes, it's amazing what we can do with the current technology nowadays.
Yeah, it's for me, it's quite reassuring to see the resilience in our systems and your systems and how it still works. So we got a little bit of time this morning to talk about what you're seeing in the CAMS data that reflects the current crisis, changes and human behaviors, and also maybe a little bit about how CAMS fits into the, I guess, health monitoring and public health system.
Well, in CAMS, of course, it contributes or it adds to the information which is already provided by satellites. And we are seeing some very nice trends and images from Sentinel-5P, for example. So this goes around the world, and it's a very nice way at looking at things. The only thing with the satellite information as such, of course, is that it provides an indication of the full column of the atmosphere. And of course, mm-hmm. it also depends on when the signal is good. What we try to do with CAMS is to combine satellite information with in situ measurements, so measurements on Earth. We work together with the European Environmental Agency to provide this information, and combine this with our models to see how we can, in fact, fill the gaps and make seamless maps and graphs. Throughout Europe, throughout the globe, on how concentrations evolve, and not only at column level, so the full atmosphere, but also at nose level. And nose level is, of course, important when we talk about health. When we talk about health, we need to know what we, as human beings, get into our lungs and how it affects us. And we provide several levels of information. So we have concentration maps, which we provide at certain regions in Europe. We have...
So what kind of, when you say concentration maps, what kind of concentrations of what?
So when we talk about concentration maps, these are maps of 10 by 10 square kilometers. We measure different pollutants in the air which affect air quality, and examples which are in particular relevant now for COVID-19 are PM10, so particulate matter, and NO2. NO2 is largely influenced by traffic, and you know, with the lockdown situation, of course, it's one of the elements which dropped. And these are typical things which we measure. We also measure PM2.5, so the finer particulate matter is also an element which we measure, which is particularly in interesting scope of COVID-19.
Yes, Stan, is now a question on going beyond what we measure now, and we turn the perspective to assess in the next month how exceptional and how was the impact also on the pollutants and on the greenhouse gases. Is there any plan to work on that item that will be important for the next years?
It's a very interesting question, Federico. Of course, it's something that needs to be assessed together with, in the long term. So when we really want to assess the impacts, we need to look at trends, and we need to look and compare the trends with the long term period in the past. So we have records which go back for many years. So this information is there, so we can check what was the situation before the lockdown. And a typical period could be 2017 to 2019, which we use as an average. Mm-hmm. And now we are looking in what the trends are over the months. We track this over the different regions. And then, of course, we need to see how this influenced by the changes in emissions, but also weather. Weather is, of course, also an important indicator, which influences how concentrations in the air are influenced, and also as a consequence, how this air potentially can impact human health. Another element is, of course, not only the pollutants, but also the pollen. Pollen also an indicator which influence respiratory health and how people are affected in their ability to breathe. And of course, if you combine this with the impacts of COVID-19, where this has a major impact on the ability to breathe, it's an interesting element to look at. So, Alan, if we talk about long-term assessments of impacts, we need to have sufficient data to go back to make a decent comparison, and we need to have sufficient data to look at the trends. And currently we are doing this. So we're doing this on a daily basis. If we talk about CO2, of course, that's another element. So we're mainly focusing on pollutants or air quality. We're also looking at concentrations of CO2. But on this, we shouldn't confuse air pollution with climate change.
So there's actually, I think you've just uncovered sort of several areas. One is in CAMS, you have a nice long time series of data. How long is your time series?
We go back to more than 10 years of reanalysis data, which we have available under CAMS, yes.
Okay, that's cool. So that means what that means is I can't go back and choose. If I want to do a comparison between now and any year, I don't go and choose just one year because that year might have had slightly more or slightly less than usual. I can take the 10-year record and do a nice comparison.
You have mentioned the link between air quality and climate. And ACNWF is also house of another fundamental service that is managed and is part of the Copernicus, is the climate change. Is there also something that you are doing to support the commission with C3S for the COVID crisis? Is there any information that you are providing that may be fundamental for this?
Yeah, so we talked about pollutants, which influence air quality and public health on this. We talked about CO2 concentrations. But another element which is of relevance is, of course, climatology. And if we think about temperature, if we think about humidity, these are elements which influence the seasonality of certain viruses. We see this with influenza, the normal flu, as we know, there is a certain seasonality, and there are different factors, of course, which influence this. The fact that at winter time you're all sitting together, more at home, more closely together, there's an element. But if we look at the environmental elements, it's humidity, it's temperature, which are our main driver. And there are more and more indications that also for COVID-19, there is an indication that there's a link between seasonality and the spread of the virus. On the other hand, it's not the only one.
So again, where's that? Who does that research? Who's doing that research?
So if we talk about seasonality and if we talk about the impacts of COVID-19 on public health, we look, of course, to the world of public health specialists, of virologists, yeah, of epidemiologists. And they have a great deal to tell about this. Of course, it's a new virus. COVID-19 is not known yet. And there's a lot of advancement made over the last couple of weeks and months. What we're trying to do is to co-create knowledge together with them. So we try to reach out to them and indicate, look, in Copernicus, we have a world of information coming from satellites. We have a world of information coming from in situ measurements, from combining these with models. And we translate this to something which can be useful for them to do further research. Further research to better understand how this virus spreads. Further research to look at the impacts linked to, for example, the fact that we all locked down at home at the moment. And this gives some very great insights to further investigate, not only for now, but also, for example, if there would be... throughout Europe, we see that more and more countries are moving out to this phase of a lockdown. But maybe if we go into autumn and winter, we see that it comes back. And by making sure that we know and better understand the situation and that we see and understand better the link between environmental aspects and climate aspects, we can maybe better understand and be prepared. And Copernicus has a big added value to this, be it from satellites or models or other measurements.
Yeah, you mentioned that the first step is to co-work or provide that is important information to epidemiologists or a category of users that may need it to integrate their research. But is this information available to all users or to a wide group of users within Europe and worldwide? And if yes, how?
Yes. Copernicus is open and free. It's a service. So the word service means that we are there to support users. We are there with a use support service. We are there with trainings if needed. And we are there with a group of specialists, with scientists who support the interpretation of the data. All this information is there. We have websites and created some microsites where they can go to, not only for the specialists, but also for journalists and people who are interested to know better about the situation and see what are the trends and how to do the interpretation. So it's open and free, and it comes with full support, both on technical aspects as well as scientific aspects. And I can confirm that a lot of entities working on Copernicus, be it at EUMETSAT or ECMWF, we are fully committed to support the health community, to support the specialist with information which enables them to study the situation further.
It's one thing I think that I personally get quite excited about Copernicus. The data provision is huge, and that's cool. The model data provision is also just enormous and is great. But I think in a strange way, one of the things I get most excited about is it's somehow working to break down institutional barriers and move data and information between different domains of expertise. So like you've got your knowledge of how the environment works, how the atmosphere works, all the feedback mechanisms, all the complexity that goes with that. And the system is structured so that it's a little bit easier than maybe it was 10 years ago to actually work with public health experts and people in other scientific domains. Are you actually seeing the benefit of that? Is it real for you?
It's a very nice remark, Mark, and I agree. This is something which we really see in Copernicus. Copernicus enables users to abstract data in an easier way, which would have never been able if there's not public bodies like EUMETSAT, like ESA, like ECMWF, who are doing all the number crunching before. So there's a lot of information behind this and a lot of knowledge which is needed to be able to derive, in fact, the relevant information and knowledge to do this. We can provide, in fact, in this way, a service, not only for the specialist as such, but also for other specialists who translate it to the public health specialist.
Well, that's the bit where it gets really cool, because then it becomes meaningful for the citizen right at the end. You know, that's how it becomes meaningful for me. In my everyday life, when I'm not being scientist me, I'm getting my public health advice is informed by this. The stuff I get from the Robert Koch Institute in Germany
is informed by this work, and that just for me is quite exciting.
One of the incredible points that that I personally see in the COVID crisis is that there is a new and very fast need for information from citizens, but also from stakeholders. The chain of decisions, we have mentioned, for instance, this phase two and the reopening. Really needs this type of support to take decisions. Is a new phase of decision taking. And I think that the services that are implemented in Copernicus, they are playing and will play a much bigger role. But this is also endeavoring, because we really need to provide correct information and information that is reliable. For instance, can you give us some examples on how you do to validate and to provide a quality check of the information that you give to all these large sort of users and public?
Of course, quality control is an important element, and it's not only control, but it's also to indicate the users the boundary conditions within which they can use this information. So it needs to come with the correct documentation. It needs to come with uncertainty margin in a way to illustrate, well, if we give you some figures, if we give you some concentrations, well, this is the boundary within which we are telling you this. And this is illustrated in our graphs. This is illustrated in our raw data which we provide. So if you're a specialist, you can assess this. And this is done, of course, on a regular basis. So this is embedded in the service. This is an operational element. And of course, it's crucial to remain reliable and to remain scientifically sound.
What have you learned about how to display that kind of information or to share? Because uncertainty information or the bound, you know, when I say it's this number, it's this number, plus or minus a little bit. What have you learned about communicating and displaying that in the last few years? Because that's tricky.
It's tricky. And it depends on the user. So some users really need this for their own interpretation. Other people simply want an absolute figure. And then they need the expert knowledge. They need a scientist who explains what behind the data. And we work on both levels. We work both on documentation, on supporting users to understand this, to give trainings so they understand what it means. And then we give the data as such, which with uncertainty margins, for them to do the interpretations. But it remains, it's true, there is some education needed depending on the user you're talking to. Some understand, others need more information. And we have to respect this. I think Copernicus is there. So we are, in fact, the value chain. So you see the different providers of data, knowledge, and then you have different types of users. You have the expert users. You have the users who are able to translate what we provide, combine it with others. And then you have the end users, policymakers, business makers, the citizens in general. And we need to be able to cater for all of them, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, because we have the same thing, because ECM.ref and CAMS, you're one of our big users. So the Sentinel satellites that we look after and the data we pass on to you and all of the UMetSat satellites. And, of course, it's one of the big things when we talk as organizations, not only is the data flowing, is the data good, it's exactly how good. Because, it's good. That's not enough. It's this much good. And measured on a regular basis and properly validated and the methodology behind doing all of that. And that then makes a difference to what you can do because it directly feeds into the certainty of your modeling output. So the better we do, the better you can do and so on. What are some of the things we're going to see in the next, say, 5 to 10 years when it comes to public health and CAMS? Is there some sort of innovation we might expect or you hope for? That's a big question.
It's a big question, yes. I think there's a clear link between air quality and health and public health. Well, the statistics are there, the information is there, and we also see that if you look at the concerns by citizens, and one of them is, of course, climate change, but also air quality is one of the concerns of a lot of citizens. What we can provide in Copernicus is this data. We can support public health sector to provide this information. And what's key in this whole process is co-creation of knowledge. Co-creation of knowledge, I mentioned it before, it's so important. So,
so what does it actually mean? What does it mean to co-create knowledge?
Co-create knowledge is that... in fact, the two communities come together and one explains to the other that the specific needs and you try to combine knowledge from both sides to derive added value information. It means that you work together hand in hand with specialists, and sometimes you need people who are able to translate both information sources and needs. But it's also the only way to see and make sure that we develop some services which are user relevant. Because as a climate specialist or an air quality specialist, you can say, well, this is what we provide and look at how great it is. And even with all the uncertainties and things like this. And then the public health specialists come, but in fact, I need another type of resolution. I don't understand your language. We use other words and other terminology. And this additional step is so crucial to make sure that we do this gap analysis and to make sure that we move towards what they need. And that's why we have something like what we call the URDB, the User Requirement Database, so where we collect all this type of information from users and see how we can fill the gaps in how we produce data, make sure that they are more and more relevant to users, be it directly, the end users, or via intermediates, small SMEs.
So in some ways, this database is a database of their actual questions rather than the questions you think they've got. These are the questions they're actually asking.
Indeed, yeah.
And which is always quite challenging, actually, to really go, okay, how do we really help these people rather than kind of nearly help these people?
Yeah, and I mean, you are mentioning users or persons and association institutes with which you are co-working. Can you give us the numerical dimension? I mean, how many users, how many persons, how many institutions are working with you or make use of the service in CAMS and C3S?
Oh, it's a lot. So I think for C3S we are reaching 40,000 users using the climate data store. With CAMS, it's also a lot. I don't have the absolute figure, but a thing which we have to remember, and this is true for all for all entities involved in Copernicus. A lot of information which we use is used. You have secondary users also. So what we provide on a daily basis to a particular, for example, university or an SME, they repackage this data and they use it in other ways. A nice example is always like people who have an iPhone, for example. If you look at the weather app which you have there, and then you go a little bit deeper, nowadays they also provide the pollution data, so information about air quality. What's behind there is CAMS, the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. So it reaches millions of people. Millions of people rely on this type of data to get an indication about air quality. And of course, if you look at the statistics as such, it's not there. But this illustrates that we are part of a value chain. So we have the satellites, we have the in-situ measurements, we have the models, and all these entities involved in Copernicus feed into a massive amount of users, be it directly or indirectly. And it's hard to measure, but it's much more than the figures we can provide here.
Yeah, that's really cool. I like that. So there's a couple of websites. If people do have an iPhone, have a look at your iPhone, and you'll be able to see the CAMS data there. You can also go to www.atmosphere.copernicus.eu for the Atmosphere Monitoring Service. And if you're interested in the climate change service, you can go to www.climate.copernicus.eu. Shin, thank you for your time. One of the things that I've really liked over this lockdown period is the connections between UMetSat and ESIMWWF and C3S and CAMS. They're all still going, even though, because we meet a lot and talk and share, and that's all still going. So when you do get to see your colleagues, do say hi from us. But also, it's a privilege and a pleasure to work with you. And thank you very, very much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy your day. Bye.
Okay. So thank you, Federico. It's a joy to speak with you again.
And thank you very much. And thank you to our listener. And we hope that you enjoyed and had interesting information from us.
And if people want to follow you on Twitter, can they do that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm not really a social media guy, but my Twitter account is there, so you can find things there.
So people can also follow your work on the UMetSat website, where you've got case studies and the courses that you're preparing. There's information there. Also, like to thank Shin Fumota for joining us and talking to us about the work of CAMS. And I really look forward to seeing you again, Federico, in a couple of months. Next month, I'll be joined by our ocean expert and guide, Dr. Hayley Evers-King, and we'll be talking about the effect that artificial light has on various ocean species and how we can monitor that from space. So do join us then. In the meantime, take care and enjoy using the data day to day.